You are listening to Bible Direction for Life, the sermon podcast of Westside Baptist Church in Bremerton, Washington. We pray that the preaching and teaching you hear on this podcast connects the truth of the Bible to your life, that you would learn more about the triune God who made you and what he made you for. In the following lesson, entitled Shaped by Truth, Pastor Peter Montoro explains how the individual stories that we consume shape our understanding of the big story in which we live.
So last week, we talked about being valiant for truth. We talked about how to evaluate ideas, and especially we talked about how to interact with the news, and a lot of the examples were how to live as a Christian in the world of politics. Not that that's the only place where ideas show up, but we talked about evaluating ideas. And so tonight, we're going to talk about how to evaluate stories. And while fighting for ideas is vitally important, in the end, it is the stories, both the stories that we take in and the stories that we tell, that do more than anything else to shape the course of our lives. So we're going to begin by talking about understanding stories, how stories shape our worldview, and how our worldview takes a storied form. And then we'll talk about seeing stories. Stories are everywhere. And we'll talk about how to spot stories in our lives. And then we will move on to evaluating stories, seeking out stories that are true and strong and beautiful. So understanding stories, seeing stories, evaluating stories, that's what we're hoping to work through tonight. Well, that's what I'm hoping to work through tonight. And hopefully you all will be on board with that, because otherwise this won't work very well. So to begin with, though, we're talking about understanding stories, and story is a bigger category than we often realize. So before we go on, I should ask, how would you define, just briefly, how would you define the idea of a story? When I say story, what do you think of? Anyone? History? That's a good one. Anyone else?
Fiction.
Fiction? Brother Huff, that's a good one, too. Anyone else? One more. Benji.
A setting, plot, climax, and ending.
That's good too. Those are all parts of story. Now, we might be tempted, particularly in some traditions of Christianity or some schools of thought, we might be tempted to think that all that's really important are the ideas, the propositions, the explicit statements that we believe about the world. Now, correct ideas are very important, as we focused on last week. Yet we need to realize that we are not encyclopedias of correct or incorrect ideas. That's simply not how human beings were created. There is more to us than the true propositions that we have lined up in our minds. Now, as human beings, we are embodied creatures. We're embodied in a particular time and a particular place. If you are here tonight in this room, I am confident of a few things, one of which is that all of you are in your bodies. All of you are embodied creatures. If you were not an embodied creature, you would not be able to be present in this room as a human being. You would be elsewhere in another world. So as humans, if we are alive, we are embodied creatures, embodied in a particular time and space. All that we do in a particular body. And just as we are embodied creatures, so also, and in the same way, we are enstoried creatures. We're embodied and enstoried. All that we do in a particular story. To be embodied in a particular time and a particular space is to belong to a particular story. Since we are God's creatures, all of us, we exist in the space and the time that he created, which, as it turns out, it's the only space and time that there is. And if we're to understand and evaluate stories well, we need to begin by understanding the connection between being embodied and being enstoried. So just as space and time, for you science nerds, you know that there is a space-time there is a connection between space and time. Ultimately, they cannot be separated. And in the same way, there is a connection between bodies and stories. They cannot be separated either. Now, in this matter of embodiment, we can either live our lives in keeping with the reality of the bodies that we have been given, Or we can ignore those bodies and try to live as though they have nothing to say to us. Now, this could take forms that anyone in society would recognize are ridiculous. So, your body is subject to the laws of gravity. You can try to live as though your body is not subject to the laws of gravity, but it will come to a very bad end because your body is subject to gravity. And if you jump off of a high building, you will discover that what you believe about the world doesn't really make any difference. What makes a difference is the way your body is constructed and the way the world is made. And if you jump off a high building and you don't have a parachute or a sail or something of that sort, you are going to hit hard and it's going to be a sad ending if you jump from high enough. In the same way, you were created as male or female. You can try to live in contradiction to that reality, but it is not going to work. It is not going to work well at all if you try to live in a way that is contrary to what every cell in your body says is true of you. And we've talked quite a bit about that in recent months. So in the matter of embodiment, we can either live our lives in a way that is in keeping with the bodies that we've been given, or we can try to ignore what our bodies are telling us and live in contradiction to that. And in the same way, in this matter of enstoryment, we can either live our lives in keeping with the reality of the story that we've been placed into, or we can ignore God's story and try to come up with our own, as many do. And yet when our stories don't match his story, they don't work in his world. Because the simple truth is that whether we acknowledge it or not, we live in God's story. In his story, we live and move and have our being. Our enstoryment is as inescapable as our embodiment. God's story, revealed to us in the scriptures, tells us who we are, where we are, what is wrong with our world, what the solution to this wrong is, and at what time in the story we find ourselves living. And the answers to these questions, which of course by this list of questions is by no means original to me, the answers to these questions are what is known as our worldview. And since we'll be returning to these questions frequently throughout the remainder of our time tonight, let me run over them one more time. The first question is, who are we? What is our identity? Second, where are we? How do we fit in with the rest of the world? Third, what is wrong with the world? And what is bad and to be condemned? So what's wrong with the world? And that is more broadly, what is bad in the world? What do we need to condemn? What is the solution to what is wrong with the world? What is good and to be praised? And finally, what time is it? Where are we in the narrative arc in which we find ourselves? Scripture, the revelation of God, gives definitive answers to these fundamental questions. Now, of course, we could spend many weeks fleshing out those answers. For our purposes tonight, I'll be giving just the most brief of, well, just the briefest of hints. So who are we? We are God's embodied creatures. We were created for his glory, created to bear. We are the image bearers of God. That's who we are. Where are we? We live in God's world, a world which he has commanded us to steward as his representatives. What's wrong with the world? Our sin and rebellion against God and our subsequent oppression of God's creatures and creation. Because of this, we daily experience the corrupting fruit of our rebellion, and we stand under the righteous judgment of a justly angered God. That's what's wrong with the world. What's the solution? The solution is redemption. In the person and work of Jesus Christ, God became flesh and died in our place. He has called us to follow in his steps, laying down our lives so that others can join us in discipleship of Jesus. That's the solution. What time is it? It is the time in between the ascension of Jesus and his return, the time in which the exiles are being gathered and the New Jerusalem is being constructed through our life together in the church. We live in a world that is both embodied and enstoried. That's the world God made. And just as we cannot experience the world apart from our bodies, apart from your body, you have no connection to the world. And in the same way, we cannot speak about the world apart from stories. Our stories may be partial to one degree or another. They may be false, again, to one degree or another. They may fit with God's story, or they may clash with God's story, but the answer to the fundamental questions of life will always, in the end, when we've thought through it, take the form of a story, because we live in a story. In the end, there are no abstract truths, just as there are no abstract humans. There are only embodied humans and storied truths. Every truth and every falsehood takes its meaning from the true or false story in which it is end-storied. Because we live in an end-storied world, the answers to the questions of worldview will all ultimately form part of a story that will either fit with the big story of Scripture or stand in tension or even contradiction to that story. Story is therefore a much bigger category than we realize. Before we can talk about how to evaluate stories anywhere, we need to learn to see stories everywhere because they are everywhere. Story is the structure of the universe. Any questions before we move on? Anyone over here? All right. Well, I've either been very clear or very confusing, so we'll move forward. Where do stories show up in your life? Where'd be some places where stories would show up? Television. That's a good one. That may not be a good source for stories, but it is a good... It is a place where stories show up. It's a good answer. That is for sure. Where are some other places? Brother Nate.
At the dinner table.
At the dinner table. Conversation, stories show up.
Work.
You hear stories at work.
Family.
You hear stories from your family. Amber.
You talk to elderly people.
Yes, they have lots of stories.
Books.
Books. Reading books is a place that you would hear stories or read stories.
Life experiences.
You live. Your life is a story. So you're living in a certain way, and that is telling a story. You're telling a story by the way you live your life.
Sermons.
You hear stories in sermons, especially when Brother Josh preaches. He gets lots of stories in. He shapes it in a story, and it's really, I always like listening to Brother Josh's preaching.
School?
Yeah, you learn stories in school. Do you think you learn stories only in literature in school? Where'd be some other subjects you might learn stories?
History, Bible.
What'd be another subject you might not think of as a story, but one that tells a story anyways?
Science.
Lunch?
Math.
That was the answer I was looking for. Math is a story. It tells a story about the world. And you can either tell it in a way that is in keeping with the world. 2 + 2 is a true story about, equals 4 is a true story about the world. 2 + 2 = 5 is a false story about the world. One that is not in keeping with the way the world has been constructed. So those are all places that we could hear stories. Now, I want us to think about, though, how these worldview questions, how these big questions show up in unexpected places, how these macro questions show up at the medium and the micro level. So last week, we talked a good bit about how to engage with ideas, referring to the world of politics. So a lot of the examples came from the world of politics. We need to realize that political pitches are in the end not simply statements of fact or opinion. They are stories that seek to persuade you to give a particular answer to the worldview questions we outlined above. So, you've got a politician. He's giving you his stump speech on television or whatever. So you look at a political ad on television. And it doesn't really matter who is running for office. They all tell a very similar story. Who are we? We are people in crisis. If the right answer is not given at this election, the world is going to fall apart. We are in crisis. Where are we? We live in a nation state whose future is determined by the next election. Doesn't matter. It's always determined by the next election. That's where we are. What is wrong with the world? Well, the wrong people are in power, or if the person running the ad is in power, then the wrong people seek power. And if they gain power, they will destroy everything that you hold dear. What is the solution? I am. Give me your trust, your money, your vote, your confidence, and I will solve your problems. What time is it? It is the time of eschatological decision. The country is one election away from total destruction. This is the story that is told by political ads. All of them, from all parties. If they're running television ads, I can almost guarantee this is the story they are telling about the world. And irrespective of the best person to vote for, this is not a true story about the world. Advertisements work the same way. Just as political speeches tell a particular story about the world, so also do television and other advertisements. As Neil Postman put it long ago, the majority of important television commercials take the form of religious parables, organized around a coherent theology. Like all religious parables, they put forth a concept of sin, intimations of the way to redemption, and a vision of heaven. They also suggest, what are the roots of evil, and what are the obligations of the holy? In television commercial parables, the root cause of evil is technological innocence, a failure to know the particulars of the beneficent accomplishments of industrial progress. This is the primary source of unhappiness, humiliation, and discord in life. Television commercials and other commercials tell a story about the world. Who are we? We are needy people. Where are we? We are in a position to act on this need. What is wrong with the world? We do not have what we need. And what is the solution? Purchasing whatever the advertiser is selling. If we'll buy the right car or the right clothes or take the right treatment for our hemorrhoids or whatever it happens to be that they are selling, we will experience heavenly bliss or something remarkably close to it. If you buy the right car, you will have beautiful women at your disposal. If you take the right breath mint, you will find yourself a glorious beau. If you invest money in the right bank, you will have a vacation to Hawaii or whatever it might be. It was interesting. Neil Postman was talking. This is actually an older book about television commercials, that a trip to Hawaii is like the closest stand-in for heavenly bliss in American television that is portrayed as the glimpse of what will happen if you take the right way out of your technological innocence and you buy whatever is being sold. It always seems to end up there. And what time is it? It is time to act, for this deal, this opportunity for bliss will not last long, and you too could be left standing at the gate with the virgins who did not take enough oil in their lamps, and you will be shut out from your opportunity for eternal reward. That's the story that's told by most television commercials. They are not selling a product, they are selling a story, and the story is not a true one. It's a simulacrum. It's a substitute story for God's story. And we won't take the time to work through each of these in detail, but when we understand what stories actually are, we'll begin to see that stories are everywhere. Social media posts tell stories. Even if it's a single picture on Instagram, ultimately, the way it communicates to us is by telling us a story. Often the story is, if you will have this product that has been supplied to me for free by this company, if you will spend a lot of money for it, then your life can be as worry-free as I have airbrushed my life to look like. That's the story that is told by Instagram influencers most of the time. Video games, they tell stories. And of course, the things that we say in conversation, we share stories. And movies and TV tell stories, and articles and books tell stories. Stories are everywhere. And now that we've talked about how to define stories, how to understand how stories work, and how to see stories, we can move on to the task of evaluating stories. Because it isn't just enough to take in whatever stories come at us. We need to learn to think critically about stories, to see the way they are working on us, and to curate the stories that are coming at us so that we can be shaped, our lives can be shaped, the lenses through which we view the world can be shaped to help us to see the world accurately and to live lives that reflect God's story rather than the false stories that surround us. Any questions about seeing stories before we move on? Evaluating stories. What are some questions we could use to evaluate the stories that we come in contact with? What are some questions we could ask?
Why
Benji? Is it true? That's a good question.
Is it godly?
Is it godly? I think the question we want to ask is it shaping us to be godly? So a more useful question. But I think what you're getting at was it's certainly a good thing to be considering. Sean?
Why is the story being told?
Why is the story being told? For whose benefit is this story being told? That's a good question to be asking, surely. Yeah, what's the story behind the story even sometimes? Is that...
And I think a photographer or a painter or an artist, whatever the medium they're using, they are telling a story. And so you just have to ask... I guess I wonder about the individual who is presenting that work, you know? What has driven them to portray a certain...
Yeah, those are definitely, as we're evaluating stories, those can be helpful questions to get into. Brother Nate?
What's the conflict and how is it resolved?
Yeah, like what is wrong with the world and what is presented just to fix it? Like those are the solid questions to be asking. Sweetheart?
I just thought of the verse Philippians 4:8. It gives us how to think on these things, but of like a good report and being pure and lovely.
Yes. So simply because something isn't obviously evil doesn't mean that it's positively good. Given the power of story to shape the way we see the world, it is in fact the subtle dangers that we need to be most on the alert for. Now, content filters, that is what my wife pointed out, is a story like in terms of what is actually in the story, the content of the story, those are necessary. So content filters, are we taking filth into our lives that is going to pollute us with wickedness that, as Paul says, should not even be spoken about? So content filters are necessary, but content filters are not sufficient. Because the greatest danger isn't that our eyes or our mind would be defiled, though that is a danger and one that we should be aware of, but that our understanding of the world would become warped and our ability to act in the world would become stunted. And so we've talked about content, really, in terms of the content that one might seek out actively. Those content filters are more a matter of the orientation of your heart than your understanding and analysis and evaluation of stories. So we've talked about that on other occasions, but we're going to focus on how to evaluate stories that don't necessarily have any obvious content problems, but are still going to affect the way we see the world. And so we're going to talk about three different filters through which to evaluate stories. The first and most important, of course, is truth. And we're going to talk about how to ask questions about the truth of stories. We've already touched on this a little bit. The second is the strength of stories. And the third is the beauty of stories. So we're going to talk about evaluating stories for truth, evaluating stories for strength, and evaluating stories for beauty. Does anyone remember what those three are? Truth, strength, beauty. That's what we're going to talk about. So we're going to start by talking about truth. Now, some might assume that the difference between true stories and false stories is the difference between fiction and nonfiction. But when we understand the way that stories shape our worldview, we can see that this is a false dichotomy. Every human story, whether it is found in an encyclopedia or a novel, gives answers, whether explicit or implicit, to the fundamental questions of worldview that we mentioned earlier. Who are we? Where are we? What's wrong with the world? What's the solution? And what time is it? When we speak of evaluating the truth of stories, the fundamental difference isn't between fiction and nonfiction, but between stories that take their pitch from God's story and stories that are out of tune with the universe, stories that harmonize with God's story, and stories that clash with God's story. Now, all human stories are going to be a little bit out of tune. But there is a big difference between getting a few notes wrong and replacing the melody track with the sound of garbage cans being thrown down metal stairs. Getting a few notes wrong and replacing the melody are different problems. Stories, as we have seen, either express or presuppose answers to the big questions in life. They create worlds that either help us to live in God's world or push us to ignore God's world. And whether it is fiction or nonfiction, is the ultimate test of truth in a story. There is, for example, much more truth in the stories of Narnia than there is in the pages of the New York Times, even though one is labeled as fiction and the other purports to be nonfiction. At the end of the day, Narnia, for the most part, takes place in God's world, a place where God's rules apply. On the other hand, most of the stories, not all of them, but many stories in the New York Times, regardless of whether or not they get the facts correct, are told as if they took place in a world that does not belong to God, a world in which God's rules do not apply. In other words, the point that I'm getting at is this: because we lived in a storied world, fictional stories can and do communicate truth, just as factual stories can and do communicate lies, even without getting the facts themselves wrong, which of course is a separate problem and one that we talked about last week. In both cases, the question is how things are being seen, rather than what is being seen. It's the lenses that we're using to see the world, not the portion of the world that we're looking at. And sometimes an artificial environment is necessary to help correct our lenses. So when you go if you go to the dentist and get work done on your glasses, there is a problem. when you go to the eye doctor, you put your eyes up, at least when I was a kid, and this is how they did it when I was a kid. You went to the eye doctor and they put your eyes into this big machine where they're flipping levers and asking, can you see this? Can you see this? Can you see this? It's actually being projected, right? You're not out in the real world looking at things. But what they're doing is they're helping to get you the accurate lenses you need to correct your astigmatism or to correct your nearsightedness or farsightedness so that you can see the world accurately. The goal is to get your lenses as accurate as they possibly can be so you can see the world accurately. And in the same way, stories, fictional stories even, can have that same effect. By putting you in a controlled environment, the writers can actually influence the lenses that you use to see all the world more than those who are telling, than those who are perhaps giving you a news article, because they're actually focused and able to zero in on that work of lens adjustment. That's the value of stories to help us live in God's story, and that's the danger of stories, to lead us to live in a way that is out of account, out of line with God's story. So even more than a mere recitation of facts, stories have a way of reshaping the way we look at the world. Let me give you a few examples from Scripture that can help to explain how this works. Think of David. David had committed adultery with Bathsheba. In order to cover up his crime, he had secretly caused Uriah to be killed by the Ammonites. He had then publicly married the wife of his fallen soldier, building his reputation as a loving king who took care of the needs of his widows. The story David told himself and others gave all the wrong answers to the fundamental questions of life. Who am I? I'm the king, and I can do whatever I want. Where am I? I'm on the throne, and I'm untouchable by ordinary justice. What's wrong with the world? Nothing. What was wrong with the world was Uriah, who stood in the way of my desires. What would be wrong was if word got out of what I had. What would be wrong with the world is if word of what I had done got out. People wouldn't understand that I'm the king and I have the right to do what I want. I have needs that ordinary people don't have, and I deserve this woman that I've taken. What's the solution? Keeping things under wraps permanently. What time is it? Time to relax from warfare to enjoy the fruits of being a successful king, including the embrace of Bathsheba. That was the story that David's life was telling. David's life, in other words, was being lived in a way that was radically out of tune with God's story. And the prophet Nathan could have come to David and simply given him a recital of these facts. Instead, he came with a story. Let me read it to you. The Lord sent Nathan unto David, and he came unto him and said unto him, there were two men in one city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had exceeding many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing, save one little ewe lamb which he had brought up and which he had bought and nourished up. And it grew up together with him and with his children. It did eat of his own meat and drank of his own cup and lay in his bosom and was unto him as a daughter. And there came a traveler unto the rich man, and he spared to take of his own flock and of his own herd to dress for the wayfaring man that was come unto him, but took the poor man's lamb and dressed it for the man that was come to him. And David's anger was greatly kindled against the man, and he said to Nathan, as the Lord liveth, the man that hath done this thing shall surely die. And he shall restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and because he had no pity. And Nathan said to David, thou art the man. And though David had blinded himself to his own oppression in the real world, Nathan's story gave him a new set of glasses. And in the controlled environment of Nathan's story, David could see much more clearly than he could see out there in the world. And it reshaped the glasses with which David was looking at the world so that he was able to see himself as he really was, not as he imagined himself to be. So who am I? I'm the rich man who took advantage of my position. Where am I? I'm in a land where God's justice is at work for everyone. What's wrong with the world? I am. What's the solution? Repentance. What time is it? Time to acknowledge my sin and to plead for mercy. Nathan's story reshaped the way that David looked at the world. And when he went out and looked at the circumstances of his life, he saw them in a radically different light. Jesus, of course, did the same thing, not just once, but over and over and over again. Through his parables, he revealed to his hearers the way that the world really works. And in the light of the story, they could clearly see what was fuzzy before. Like the prophet Nathan, his stories confronted the false stories of his hearers with stories that reshaped the answers they gave to the fundamental questions of life. So we see in Scripture how this can work in a positive way, how the stories that are told can reshape the lenses with which we look at the world so that we can see the world with clarity that was absent before. But the reverse can also be true. When we come to the question of evaluating the truth of story, we need to realize that this process works both ways. Just as stories can help us to see the lies we tell ourselves about the truth, can help us to see the way we're seeing God's story wrong, so also can they influence us to abandon God's story for a lie. This is a two-way street. We see this second process at work in the book of Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 7. For the window of my house, I looked through my casement and beheld among the simple ones, I discerned among the youths a young man void of understanding, passing through the street near her corner. And he went the way to her house in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. And behold, there met him a woman with the attire of a harlot and subtle of heart. She is loud and stubborn. Her feet abide not in her house. Now is she without, now in the streets, and lieth in wait at every corner. So she caught him and kissed him, and with an impudent face said unto him, I have peace offerings with me. This day have I paid my vows. Therefore came I forth to meet thee diligently to seek thy face, and I have found thee. I have decked my bed with coverings of tapestry, with carved works, with fine linen of Egypt. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of loves until the morning. Let us solace ourselves with loves, for the goodman is not at home. He's gone a long journey. He has taken a bag of money with him and will come home at the day appointed. With her much fair speech, she caused him to yield, and with the flattering of her lips, she forced him. He goeth after her straightway as an ox goeth to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till a dart strike through his liver, as a bird hasteth to the snare, and knoweth not that it is for his life. She too told a story. Who are we? We are independent agents who have no obligations that we need to worry about. Where are we? We're alone, and no one is watching, and no one will see. What is wrong with the world? Well, because we're apart, your life is boring and it lacks enjoyment. What's the solution? Come home with me. What time is it? It's the time to feast. I have peace offerings with me. That meant she had slaughtered some animals. She had good meat to eat. I have food, and I have the pleasures of my company. Come home with me. It's the time that it is, and no one is going to get in our way or stop us. Notice carefully, nothing the woman in Proverbs 7 says is necessarily factually false. Now, we don't know if she's telling the truth or lying, but her story would work, even if everything that she said was true. It may very well be the case that everything she said was technically true, and yet the story that she told pulled the simple young man away from God's story and towards destruction. That was a story that brought death. And it's a story that is told in movie after movie after movie after movie after novel after novel after novel after television show after television show after television show. That is a familiar story. It is a false story. And it is a story that is present everywhere in our world. At the most fundamental level, therefore, stories are true or false, not based on whether they are fiction or nonfiction in genre, but based on whether or not and the degree to which they conform to the story that God is telling with the world. Whether or not and the degree to which they help us to live in a way that matches the way that God has created the world to work. Please note, I'm not drawing a distinction between stories written by Christians and stories written by non-Christians. Because of common grace and universal sin, stories written by non-Christians who look carefully at the world in which we live can sometimes draw us closer to God's story, and stories written by Christians who fail to observe how God's world really works can sometimes draw us farther away from God's story, shaping our stories for evil rather than for good. Second, we need to realize that stories can sometimes get one element really right while being wrong on other points. So there could be a story that gets really right what's wrong with the world, and it draws our attention to something wrong with the world that we might otherwise have missed, even while it gets the solution wrong. In fact, most stories will be like that. The only story that gets everything right is God's story. When we go to tell stories to help us see God's world better, we'll get some things more right than others. Like ingredients, we have to consider stories not abstractly, but rather consider how they fit into the dish of our lives as a whole. Something that might be wholesome in moderation for one person could bring, in immoderation, or even in the same amount, could bring destruction to the dish of someone else's life. So some spices are very helpful in some dishes and very destructive in other dishes. So we need to consider, not abstractly, this story is good or bad, but is this story good or bad for me to be hearing? How is it shaping the way that I view the world? So I am very nearsighted. So I have glasses that help me to see things far away. If I take these off, I could not swear that these are people rather than mannequins, unless you move. That's how bad my eyesight is. But some of you that are here are, I may have the names wrong. So I can't see things that are far away. I actually can't see anything that's farther away than about that. But some of you can see things far away, but can't see things that are close up. So you need a different set of glasses. In fact, I also have astigmatism. My two eyes are of different strengths. And so if I were to turn my glasses around and swap them, they also wouldn't work. You need, when you're this matter of correcting vision, you need to be very focused. You need to be considering what's going to help me to see correctly. What's going to help my children with the strength and the weaknesses that they have? What blend of stories is going to help them see the world correctly? And so this is a very focused and particular thing. So therefore, when we seek to evaluate the stories that we're taking in, we need to ask how these stories are shaping the answers that we give to the fundamental questions of life. We need to learn to be active watchers and listeners and readers. A content filter alone is not enough. We have to consider how it is affecting the lenses by which we see the world. So when we watch movies or TV shows, when we encounter advertisements, whether commercial or political, when we scroll our social media feeds, if we have them, these are the questions we need to be asking if we're to evaluate the truth of the stories that we take in and the way these stories are shaping our view of the world. And so one of the ways that we have seen this work in our broader society is the way that homosexuality has been accepted. It's been normalized in popular culture. How is it normalized? It was normalized by telling this story over and over and over again. It goes like this. You'll recognize it. Who are we? We are people whose greatest need is to love and to be loved. Where are we? We live in a society that has an obligation to ensure that everyone has the right to love and to be loved as they define it. What is wrong with the world? There is prejudice against those who express their love in this particular way. What's the solution? Everyone needs to be free to express their love as they see fit, including redefining marriage, if that is what they desire. And what time is it? Well, it's time to normalize gay marriage and every other form of marriage and mirage that there might be. And then it's time to deal with the bigots who say otherwise. That's what time it is. Now, this story is told not primarily by, especially in the early days, this story was not primarily by talk show hosts saying, we need to have gay marriage now. That's not the primary way that the majority of the country was persuaded of this story. The way the majority of the country was persuaded of this story was TV shows that had gays cast in a positive way with this story as the backdrop to what was taking place. It wasn't what was front and foremost. It was what was in the background, unexpressed, but constantly nudging, 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 all the time nudging people to accept this kind of behavior. This isn't hypothetical. This was actually the strategy. You can read. There were books written. Let's take this strategy to normalize this kind of behavior. It's the same thing that's happening with transgenderism, and on it goes. This is how you normalize behavior. You tell stories in which that behavior is presented as normal. It's not even necessarily has to be a story about that kind of behavior. It's just a story that has a framework that normalizes that. It's the same thing with fornication. It would be hard-pressed to find any mainstream television show that doesn't present sex outside of marriage as perfectly normal and healthy and consequence-free. And the way you see that, even if you know it's wrong, the way you think about it has been shaped by the stories you've read, by the shows you've watched. It has an effect on all of us. So that's a negative example of the way the behaviors can be normalized by presenting stories in which they're perceived as normal or in which any opposition to them is portrayed as abnormal. What's a positive example of a story that has shaped the way you see the world for the better? To see the world, to see your life in terms of God's story more accurately. What would be some positive examples? Gavin?
Scripture.
Scripture, obviously, yes. Of course, Scripture is the story we're trying to conform ourselves to. But what would be other stories? Rick?
Pilgrim's Progress,
that is a good one.
Personally, the Tale of Two Cities helped me understand sacrificial love better.
Good. Anyone else?
Missionary
biographies, that's a good one. I know one that has a very significant place in my own heart is The Lord of the Rings. It's a story that, especially the way that with some of the background that I had in a particular kind of Christianity that was held by people that I loved, but that was held in a way that was toxic and ignored the broader realities of the world. And the way that the hobbits who leave the Shire relate to those who remain in the Shire was really, I might have gone a very different direction in my life without that story helping me see and love people who were difficult to love at the time and sometimes still are. And I'm sure I'm difficult to love too as well. But there was a particular way that helped me to see the world that I lived in and to see it in a way that reflected the way that I think God would see those people My life might have turned out differently without that. And so that's something that stands out in my own experience. Anyone else before we move on? All right. So negative examples and positive examples of the way that we can evaluate stories for truth and the way that stories, even stories that get some things wrong, can help us to see things in a way that would please God. So we want to evaluate stories for truth. We also want to evaluate stories for strength. Just as not all stories are equally true, so also not all stories are equally strong. Strong stories are stories that have the power to shape our answers to the fundamental questions of life. To use a food analogy, simply because something is not poisonous doesn't mean that it is nutritious. In the old days, when you had to use actual maps to find places, how many of you remember getting road directions from a map? So I never drove with a print map, but when I was a child, we did a lot of road trips. So I remember driving with a map, even though I never experienced driving with a map. And I remember helping my dad I would look at the map and I would study it and we would talk and he would ask me, you know, figure out how many miles it is to this next place on the map. So I remember that sort of thing, not as a driver, but as a, you know, well, side seat or back seat driver, wherever I happen to be. So I remember that element of it. And one of the things about a map is a map can be a perfectly blank map of the United States. Is completely accurate as long as it has the coastline right, isn't it? Is it inaccurate? No, it's accurate. Is it helpful if you're trying to drive? No, it's not. And in the same way, you can have a perfectly accurate map of the entire state, you know, but it may only have the main roads on it. And if you're going off the main roads, that map is no longer helpful. You need a stronger, more detailed map to help you get to where you're going. So simply because something is accurate doesn't mean it's actually going to help you to get where you're going. So we need to consider not only the truth of the stories we're taking in, but also the strength of the stories that we're taking in. Nathan's story, as we have seen, was not only true, it was that, but it not only fit in with the way that the world works, but it also was incredibly powerful. Even today, more than, almost 3,000 years later, over 3,000 years later, it has the power to grip our hearts, holds our attention, change the way that we see the world. Because we're embodied creatures, we need to take in food if our bodies are to have the strength to do anything. And because we are enstoried creatures, we need to take in stories if we're to have the strength to take action in the world. As Andy Wilson likes to say, stories are soul food. And if you listen to podcasts, that's a great podcast to listen to. Stories are soul food. So simply avoiding false stories is no more sufficient for our enstoryment than avoiding arsenic is for our nutrition. I'm all for avoiding arsenic. But that's a terrible diet plan, if that's all you got. We need to actively seek out stories that are both truthful and strong, both healthy and nutritious. Now, I found it helpful to think of soul food in terms of a spectrum. So if we're thinking of soul food, there's a spectrum to soul food. So on the one hand, you've got poison, no poison. You've got chaff. You've got food. So you've got and you've got a spectrum of food, and then you have vitamins, and you have medicine. So at the one end of the spectrum, you have poison. You take in enough of that, your soul's going to be awful sick. On the other hand, you've got medicine, but if all you take is medicine, you'll be as sick as the person who all they take is poison. Not as fast, but if all you take is NyQuil, you're going to be pretty sick. So you need to keep the balance on the food. If all you take is chaff, well, you won't die as fast as the person who takes poison, but you're not going to be very healthy and eventually you'll die. If all you take is vitamins, well, that won't be as bad as taking all, you know, NyQuil perpetually, but you're still going to be really sick. You need to have lots of food, no poison, a little chaff's okay, and medicine, vitamins on a regular basis in small quantities, and medicine when you need it. So let's work through this spectrum. Just like our bodies need different food on a spectrum, so also with stories. While some things are poisonous for everyone, other things may vary from person to person. And so, Andrew, if you get gluten, that's going to be poisonous to you. Now, gluten is not poisonous to me, though I have to be careful how much I ingest of it. And some of you can have all the gluten you want, and it will do nothing but good for you. What is poisonous? So some things are poisonous for everyone. Does anyone have a resistance to cyanide in here? Okay, cyanide would be poisonous for all of us. That'd be bad. No cyanide, no radioactively contaminated oranges, none of that. That would be bad for all of us. And furthermore, what's a feast for one might be vitamins or even medicine for someone else. So something that you treat as a feast that is a source of delight to you, somebody else might need to chaw through like they take vitamins. And so you could argue, just like with food, you could argue where something exactly falls on a spectrum, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a spectrum. There are foods that are objectively healthier for you than others. So spinach is definitely more healthy than deep fried butter. There is no question about that. You could argue whether deep fried butter is poison or merely junk food. But you could not argue that deep fried butter is more healthy for you than spinach unless you're allergic to spinach, which isn't really a very common allergy, though I know a lot of three-year-olds who think that it is. So let's talk about this spectrum. Poison. Any and all forms of pornography are poison for everyone. Game of Thrones is pornographic. It is poison. No Christian should participate in watching an evil show like that. I would consider that something like Twilight is poisonous as well. What would be some other things? And again, there are some things that are very clear, and there are other things that Christians can discuss. Is this merely not good for you, or is it actively poisonous for you? So there are things that there would be room for debate. What would be something that would be poisonous that you would consider? Yeah, what would be an example of a book that would be poisonous?
Harry Potter?
I think some Christians would debate on that. It depends on how you see it. So that would be like, you know, depending on who you talk to, whether they would see it that way or not. And so you'd have to do, you know, asking the questions of worldview, looking at the content. I certainly wouldn't put it in the health food category for sure. But whether it's chaff or poison is something that Christians, maybe even some in this room, would have a disagreement about. And so you've got a, you know, so you certainly could say there's unhealthy elements in it. But maybe not as much as there would be in Twilight or, you know, certainly not as much as there'd be in Game of Thrones or something like that. But that would be a decision that you'd have to make. Is this actually poisonous? Is this just bad? Is there something better I could spend my time reading? So that would be a question for sure. Anyone else?
The Shack,
yes. Theological poison. Now, if you need to write a review rebuting it and you are well-equipped, there are some times where chemists need to deal with poison. But for your devotions, Shack, poison, absolutely. That'd be a good one. One more. Sean.
People magazines and stuff like that.
Yes. Yeah, that would be news poison for sure.
Yeah.
I would agree with that. And again, not everyone would agree with that, but there could be some discussion, but I would definitely put it in that category. So part of what I'm getting at is that we need to have these buckets on our radars for what's shaping the way that we view the world. So the solution isn't that we all have exactly the same categories and classify everything the same way. If we're actually thinking about this, we're not going to do that. The solution isn't to have one divine master list of everything that is acceptable, but for us to be consciously curating a list that is helping us become more like Jesus. So, poison. But once we get off the poison and we're on sort of the food spectrum, food can go from chaff to vitamins. So at the one end, you've got poison. At the other end, you have medicine. So poison, avoid completely if you possibly can. Medicine, take as needed. And then you've got chaff, vitamins, and, you know, your daily food. What would be some chaff things? Not harmful, but not necessarily helpful for most people in most places. But it's not bad to have some chaff. You know, popcorn is not bad. If all you eat is popcorn, that's bad. But what would be some popcorn or some grass that you could eat that would not necessarily... Gavin?
Linkin Park.
Pardon? Is that a...
Music.
Okay. I am not familiar with it, so...
Hallmark Channel,
yes, exactly. It is not bad to watch the Hallmark Channel. I am not condemning the Hallmark Channel, but it is not very weighty on the food spectrum. It's like eating popcorn. It is great. Popcorn is what you eat while you watch the Hallmark Channel. But it would be a bad lunch or dinner. For children, the Hardy Boys or the Boxcar Children. Not bad. Not necessarily very good either. So it's not bad to have some of that roughage in the diet, but that's not the basis for your nutrition plan. If it is, you have a problem, and your children have a problem. What would be something else? Amber.
I think of those one-liner Bible verses, motivational quotes. They're all over Pinterest, if you're getting your fed by.
Right, yeah, that's not bad. It could be encouraging, but if that's how you interact with the scriptures, that could be harmful, if that's all you got. Anyone else? One more. What?
Family Feud,
okay. I have not watched it, but I can imagine that. I'd say most business books would be in that category. Some could be in the poison category, but most business books, that sort of thing, not necessarily harmful. They may be necessary for a particular aspect of your life, but they should not be your main diet of stories. Food. You've got snacks, light reading, things that are enjoyable and beneficial, but kind of low on the beneficial scale. You know, they're like your snack bars. And then you've got your daily rice. And we know that it has to be your daily rice and not daily bread, because rice is so much better for you. But of course, this itself makes the point that just like food, we're not necessarily going to agree on what exactly is best, precisely because what is best is a question both of culture and of the individual needs of particular individuals and of the taste of particular individuals. So that you need nutrition is universal. You can't substitute Twinkies for oatmeal without severe consequences for your health. A diet of Twinkies will not be good for you. You can debate whether or not you should have Twinkies at all, but it is not debatable that if you have Twinkies for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you will be very unhealthy. You can debate whether to have oatmeal or brown rice or basmati rice or whole wheat bread. That's a legitimate debate to have. But that you can substitute Twinkies for whole grains. Not a debate. Did you? Oh, seemed like people were pointing me over there. So what would be some things that could be in this slot in terms of food? Wholesome food.
Most classic literature?
That would be, so I have, I left one category out. So I have a feast category, which I would put, I would actually slide that over. So I forgot, I hadn't turned my page. So you have like snack, food, and feast. So if everything's in the feast category, that might not be healthy. But the feast category is where I would put that. Now, some people might put it over in the medicine category, depending on what the rest of your diet has been like. But yes, a lot of classic literature would be in the food category. Again, this is a person on, you know, a scale, you know, that most of us, I wager, would really enjoy a well-cooked steak or a medium rare or even a rare steak. Most of our kids would have to gnaw that down like medicine. So there's a maturity factor here as well. So classic literature. What would be something else in the food category?
Christian fiction?
That would be something that it really depends on the writer. That it could be all the way, a lot of what's labeled Christian fiction is, you know, radically out of accord with the Christian worldview. But healthy Christian fiction, like that could be like, it's such a broad category. It could be all the way from the poison to the medicine, depending on, you know, but good missionary stories or, you know, healthy stories that are enjoyable, history, good novels, healthy TV shows, family movies. I would put in the feast category, I would put great literature. Dostoevsky is one of my favorites, Tolkien, which could be in the meal category too. What would be something in the vitamin category? What would you think of for that category? Pardon? What? What did you say?
Anatomy and physiology?
I don't know if that's really I'm not quite sure where to map that onto this scale. But yes, it could be. That may be on the medicine. Like what you need for your, pardon? It is medicine. Yes, that too. So I have to hasten to be done here. But vitamins would be books and shows that stretch us and fill deficiencies. So the goal of vitamins is to fill out the deficiencies that you have in the things that you might like to eat normally. So vitamins are targeted. What are the things that you would not have if you didn't have those? So it's good to take in stories that are healthy but are not our thing. It's not necessarily something we would seek out or enjoy, but we need to broaden our taste, and it needs to be that corrective. And then I'd say medicine would be documentaries and books about difficult and painful topics that we may not want to talk about, but that because of our blind spots may be really helpful. So as with food, our goal should be to grow up into maturity ourselves and to help our children grow up into maturity. There's nothing wrong with enjoying chicken nuggets and mac and cheese as an adult, but there is something wrong if that is all you enjoy as an adult. We should not force feed steak to our infants, but we shouldn't give our teenagers baby food either. The goal in this matter of taking in soul food is that we should be growing up to maturity. Now, all of us are on different points on that journey, but while there's no great harm if your taste in food does not mature, you're going to miss out on a lot of pleasurable things in life. But if your taste in food doesn't mature, that's not a great harm, and it's certainly not a sin. But if your taste in stories doesn't mature, your ability to see God's world in the complexity and the beauty, and to see the brokenness that our sin has brought to God's world in its complexity and darkness is going to be stunted severely. Your ability to see accurately and take action decisively will be hindered. We all need to seek to grow in maturity in our appreciation of stories so that we can see the world accurately and take action decisively. The final point, which we'll just touch on because we're out of time, is evaluating stories for beauty. So when we talk about truth, it's does it fit with the way that God's world really works? When we talk about strength, does it have the ability to sustain us, to be soul food for us, and to help us to see accurately and to take action decisively? When we talk about beauty, we're talking about the craftsmanship of the writing or the presentation itself. If it's a film, maybe the artistry of the camera and the editing, and we're talking about a poem, the way the words fit together. God made a beautiful and an intricate world. So it's appropriate for us to tell beautiful and intricate stories. Craftsmanship alone is not enough. But just as we ought to grow in our ability to appreciate complex foods and complex stories, we ought to grow in our ability to appreciate the words, the wordsmithing, the craftsmanship of writing, or the artistry of a film or a painting, that our taste and our ability to understand real beauty ought to grow as our taste improves. Now, God is not for God is not against high brows, but he is against high noses. We should not despise what is simple, but we ought to be able to appreciate what is beautiful. There's a difference between being snooty and having good taste. And we could talk a lot more about that, but we are out of time. Conclusion: just as God has placed each of us as embodied creatures into a world of time and space, so also has he placed each of us as storied creatures into the world that his story is telling. We should seek to understand stories, to see stories, and to evaluate stories for truth and for strength and for beauty. And above all else, we need to remember that we are storied creatures. What changes our stories changes our lives. What nudges the answers we give to the big questions of life shifts the way we look at the world and transforms the way we act in the world. So if we have any more questions, yes?
Is Philippians 4:8 a good thing to overlay on the stories you should entertain?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that would go back. That's sort of the content filter, which would be a whole other lesson to be talking about. But that's a really good place to go to and to start with as an initial filter to be thinking about. All right. We have to be done because we're out of time. But if you have any more questions, you can talk to me afterwards. You are dismissed.
Thank you for listening to this message. If you would like to learn more about the Westside Baptist Church, please visit our website, www.BibleDirectionForLife.com. Subscribe to the podcast if you would like to hear new sermons and lessons each week. And remember that a sermon podcast is no substitute for opening up a Bible and reading it for yourself.